I'm going to hit record now. Do you see it recording now?
Recording now.
Now it's recording.
Okay, I'm so sorry. Like I said, it usually when I go to meeting, it's automatically recording. This has never happened.
Could I sneak in and ask a question before
the next?
Hi, I'm Chloe. I'm MD, Integrative Medicine in New York, riding out the pandemic and doing telemedicine. And today, two of my consultations were about women with IUDs. So following up to Nana's very important question.
Yes.
Women really need contraception, including people who've had unplanned pregnancies that have been quite traumatic.
Yeah.
Who are also living with some of the sequelae, I think, of their Mirena IUDs. Everybody froze. Aviva froze. It's okay. It's her. Maybe she still hears me.
I'm here. Okay. I don't know what's happening. Yeah.
So the question was, are there ways to my burning question is, can you use Vitex safely with the Mirena IUD and not compromise its integrity as a birth control? Because I didn't really know the answer to that. I've heard that you can't use it with birth control pills. That makes some sense, because if you're trying to mess with FSH and LH and then you change things that perhaps would enhance fertility. Do you think that's true, for one, that taking Vitex and birth control, whether it's a hormonal IUD or oral contraceptives or a NuvaRing, would compromise the birth control?
I've never done it, and I can't imagine in most
cases. I never did it either, because I was too
interested. Yeah, it seems sort of like it doesn't make sense. I can't think of any situation why I would actually put someone on Vitex while they were on birth control.
Okay.
Theoretically, it doesn't make any sense to me hormonally. It doesn't make any sense to me. That said, the impact of Vitex is to increase progesterone and estrogen, which is sort of theoretically what a hormonal contraceptive is doing, but you're adding those, one or the other or both, but you are actually stimulating the ovary to ovulate, to produce more progesterone. So I wouldn't do it, but I can't think of any reason why. I can't think of any health or medical reason why I would.
So the two contexts were, one were menstrual migraines that had happened before the IUD and that seemed to be still happening during the IUD. And she'd been helped by Vitex in terms of how it had seemed to help with those before, and could we restart it? I didn't know. And the second was libido changes. And could the libido changes be because of the IUD? And would that improve with time? Let's say you get the IUD like Nana just after childbirth. Yeah. As the hormone release decreases over time, should you try and ride it out while supporting the symptom, or should you be like, please take it out?
Yeah.
And anxiety about taking it out.
Yeah. So a really great question. I mean, I'd love to hear your thoughts too. With the IUD, my experience with the Mirena is that women fall into one of three camps. They get it put in, it doesn't bother them at all, and they're just happy campers. They get it put in and they hate it, and they're like, get this thing the heck out of me. Or they're like, they're not happy with it. They're having cramping, they're having spotting, they're feeling uncomfortable. And they're comfortable enough to ride it out. And my experience is that within about 6 months, most people who ride it out, because they weren't so uncomfortable that they needed it out so badly, actually do fine, and then they love it. Is that, do others of you who use IUDs in practice have similar or different experiences with it?
I mean, the pandemic has making this a little bit more complicated, because the just get it out or just wait is like a little bit more fraught for people who feel like we might be about to be in lockdown again and wanting contraception.
Yeah.
And having failed other options. So.
Yeah. As I say, having other options fail them.
Yes.
As far as treating symptoms go,
that's what
if someone is using an IUD, for example, because they're having heavy uterine bleeding from fibroids,
right,
and you're using the IUD that way, then I wouldn't have a problem trying Vitex or other herbs that may even compete with the hormonal effects to help with the symptoms. Mm-hmm. But if someone is using it for contraception and you may be reducing their contraceptive efficacy, then I wouldn't. I would find alternatives. I have never heard of, it could just mean it's never been done, any studies suggesting that you can't use Vitex and birth control, but I don't know anyone
who's done the study.
Right, exactly. I do know the studies on St. John's wort, for example, which does increase cytochrome P450 and increases clearance of estrogen. So with estrogen contraception, it's been considered contraindicated. But interestingly, in all the studies that have been done, women have lower blood levels of estrogen, but there have never been any pregnancies. So there are some thoughts that it may even be helping to clear the estrogen. I would say that the only thing that you could possibly do would be, check blood levels and then have her use a condom. And, you know, if she wants to try the Vitex and recheck blood levels, but then it seems so complicated that I would probably try something else. You could try riboflavin for the migraines. 400 of riboflavin a day has nice.
I actually sent her your link already for your,
your migraine.
So that with that protocol. So
yeah,
we're going to add other things while trying to leave the IUD for now and
great.
Like see how she does. And the libido question also, is it the Mirena that's affecting the libido or is it the pandemic? And
oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, I've seen so many different symptoms with the Mirena, everything from mental health symptoms to physical symptoms. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was the Mirena.
Yeah, like I don't know that
it's a well-documented symptom, but only because I don't know, it may be. Does anybody know if it's a well-documented symptom with the Mirena? I'm not sure that it's considered a classic symptom, but yes. any hormonal contraception can reduce libido.
Right.
It is documented because I looked it up.
You did, lower libido, yeah. And so... Yes. I mean, you can ride it out and see if it gets better.
And you can do other herbs and vitamins and other regimens too, to see if they support that symptom.
The low libido.
The low libido, or whether it's the migraine or whether it's hormonal acne that they get, or, you know, just all these other things that people do get.
Yeah. With hormonal acne, it's tough with the Mirena. That's where I'll usually go to like a low progesterone. If I think that there's hormonal acne and even like a little bit of a PCOS picture, yeah.
You do what?
I'll do a low oral progesterone, but
like a microgestin,
like a non-androgenic, like a low androgenic progesterone. I'll try different things.
So yeah, but big believer in that woman's desire to not be pregnant is super important.
Oh my gosh.
Care, and despite everything trying to be natural, that we really have to think about the consequences of unintended pregnancies on people's lives as a trauma.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, there's some really good studies coming out looking at the long-term impact on health, like 5 years out for women who had undesired pregnancies, not so much unintended, but undesired, but who maintained the pregnancy rather than terminating or maybe didn't have access to contraception. And there are a lot of physical and mental health challenges that those women experience. It's really interesting.
Thank you.
I have a question, really, really brief. Last time you mentioned black raspberry leaf, we were talking specifically about herbs for stopping diarrhea, and you said black raspberry, the whole plant. I can't find that anywhere online.
Have you looked at Mountain Rose?
Yeah, they only have red raspberry.
Have you looked at Frontier Herbs?
I haven't looked specifically on the Frontier website. I just did a Google search with the Latin name.
And
nothing came up. Except for like the dried fruit. So I don't know if anyone else has success. There was one thing on Etsy, but
most of the time we're not stopping diarrhea. The thing with diarrhea is that you really want to stop what's causing the diarrhea. It's not usually that you're actually stopping the diarrhea. So when you have infectious diarrhea, you actually don't want to use things that stop the diarrhea. You want to get rid of you want the infection to pass and you want to kill the infection. When you have like perimenstrual diarrhea, you want to address the prostaglandin levels and why is somebody having so many loose stools? If somebody has IBS, you're not so much stopping the diarrhea, you're supporting the microbiome. So stopping diarrhea isn't something that we do that often, herbally or, I mean, medically, sometimes if someone has like a traveler's diarrhea and it's non-infectious, then you might stop it or something like that. But most of the time, it's not the direction that we're going in.
Can I just go back to the Vitex or Chaseberry? Why, mm-hmm. if that's a uterine toning thing, which you would be, if someone was doing the Marina specifically for not pregnancy, but rather to stop the blood flow thing, would you recommend, before they did the Marina, would you recommend the Chaseberry to try and address the pain and heavy bleeding and all that sort of stuff through Chaseberry? Is that not
I wouldn't use Vitex as a uterine tonic. I don't think of Vitex as a uterine tonic, really. I think of Vitex as a hormonal herb. So I wouldn't use it as a uterine tonic. And I probably, it wouldn't be my first go-to for fibroids. When I think about fibroids, and we'll have a whole module on lesson on fibroids, so I'm not going to dive into that too much right now, but you can look ahead in the textbook or the course. With fibroids, you want to think about things like estrogen levels, and you want to think about insulin growth factor and blood sugar. Those are really more of the things that are likely to be feeding fibroids. So you want to stop feeding the fibroids and then use uterine astringent herbs. The best actually studied herb, which, you know, as herbs go, some have better studies and some have more moderate studies for fibroids, has actually been green tea, Epigallic catechins. So the EGCGs from green tea are a more recent kind of herbal innovation, if you will. And then you want to think about uterine astringents like yarrow, lady's mantle, blue cohosh, that are actually truly uterine astringents.
Aviva, I have a question. Yes. On the Vitex. Also, my name is Yelena, and I'm also an MD, and I'm seeing a lot of adolescents. So this is all very new to me. So if I have somebody who did not get periods, I have somebody who tells me didn't have a period for 10 months. Yeah. I didn't do labs on her, but she is at a normal weight. So, I mean, I get it. She could still have PCOS. But would Vitex be essentially similar to giving progesterone and having a withdrawal bleed? Is that, could I use that sort of instead of progesterone?
Wait, how old is she?
Her menarche was 2 years prior. So I think she was like 15 or 16.
At her menarche or now?
So she had menarche, and since menarche, maybe had 3 periods.
Okay.
And her last period was 10 months ago.
Okay. So, I mean, technically, right, from like an MD medical protocol, usually 8 months, and then we do a stimulated bleed with a progesterone withdrawal just because of the potential risk of endometrial hyperplasia. I would definitely try Vitex in that case.
And you would? You
know, the risk of the likelihood of endometrial hyperplasia leading to endometrial cancer in a 16, 17, or 18-year-old waiting 8 months, 10 months, 12 months is mm-hmm. pretty low. So I would say I would start with the Vitex, maybe do the Vitex for 2 cycles, what would be the equivalent of 8 weeks. If that doesn't bring on a bleed, I would do the progesterone challenge.
Okay.
I would say, yes, it increases progesterone. Yes, we many herbalists, including myself, progesterone, for example, is my first go-to if I have a woman who's breastfeeding. She is now, baby's 18 months. She wants to get her cycle back because she wants to get pregnant again, but she still breastfeeds. Vitex is my go-to. And numerous times I've seen a cycle come on 1 or 2 cycles down, and maybe she would have had it anyway. You know, we never know. Mm-hmm. But you're not going to get the level of, you know, with a progesterone challenge, you're going to get that in 10 days. You're going to get a good mm-hmm. level, 7 days, 10 mm-hmm. days. Vitex is not going to really be that fast.
It's going to need the 2 months to
actually
see.
It might be faster. It might be faster, but it might not. So I would give it the longer amount of time.
The dose for Vitex pretty standard, or do you vary the dose?
It is pretty standard. With tincture, it's usually 5 milliliters once a day. With the capsule, it's 180 milligrams once or twice a day. So I would go for the twice a day.
A lot of the Vitex preparations are much higher dose than that, like the commercially available.
Sometimes they're 220.
Yeah, 225. And I've heard
A lot of that's fine.
And
that's
even fine. Okay. 500, like coming from herbalists, come on to me on 500 milligrams. Is that really high?
It's not really high. The study doses are usually about 180 once or twice a day. But, you know, it's like iodine, right? Like if you look at the iodine levels in a prenatal vitamin, you know, the studies will say 200 to 250 or to 200 to 240. If you look at choline, it'll say 400 to 450 milligrams. There are ranges. And the way dosing happens is interesting too, because there's kind of three ways that things can be dosed. They can be dosed based on guesswork, you know, all of our best estimates or guesstimates. And that's usually consensus. So when I was the president of the American Herbalist Guild, we started myself, Jonathan Treasure, and Roy Upton, and Tracy, because he was the executive director at the time, we started doing surveys of herbalists and how herbalists used herbs, including doses. And Vitex was one of the ones that we used. And pretty much everyone wrote they use 5 milliliters once a day in the morning. But the thing is, that could have been something that was in my textbook, or it could have been something that Mary Bove taught, or it could have been something that Gerona Lowdog taught, and we all heard it and we all started doing it, as opposed to it being like a studied dose. So that's one way that dosing happens. We hear it and we kind of by consensus all start doing it. Another way dosing happens is traditional use. If you guys have a lot of talking in your background, if you can just hit mute, that would be great. If another way of dosing is traditional dosing, and that can be based on old pharmacopoeias. If you look, however, at like a standard European dosing, if you were to go to like Simon Mills and Kerry Bones books versus a Western US herbal book, the dosing is very different. So you'll have like, you might have in I'm just making this up, but like in a Mills and Bone book, you might have 7 milliliters twice a day, whereas we might say less. So then there's that traditional or apothecary pharmacopoeia dosing that's been brought into modern times. And then the third way of dosing is based on clinical studies. And so for example, Lavella is a great example. Lavella is a proprietary product that's made by Integrative Therapeutics. It's made with lavender oil. It's just lavender oil. And then I think it's got some canola oil as a base. It's got 80 milligrams or 81 milligrams. It's 80 milligrams. 81 is the aspirin. 80 milligrams of lavender oil. When you look at the studies of lavender oil, they've been very clearly done. 80 milligrams is the effective dose, but going to 160 milligrams a day for anxiety, sorry. Doubling that doesn't make a difference. So it's not like more isn't better. So whenever possible for me, if I'm treating a clinical condition and there is a studied dose of an herb that's proven to be effective, I will try to use that dose because it's something I can consistently repeat. Mm-hmm. If there's a traditional use, I will lean, but not a studied dose, then I'll use the pharmacopoeia dose. And then if there's not any of that that's standard, then I'll kind of use based on experience or consensus of other herbalists. And, you know, one of the advantages of working, of getting to study with me is that the other herbalists that I'm talking about are the other people who write the books and do the teaching, at least from like a Western herbal perspective, or traditional herbalists that I studied with who are saying, you know, this is what we're doing. And have done for years or decades, or my people and my tradition have done this for eons.
You know, as an MD, we get hung up on the milligrams, you know, like, how many milligrams is when the tinctures feel a little bit more scary or.
Yeah. Well, the tinctures, and we'll get into this when we talk about tinctures, but you can roughly estimate the amount of milligrams in a tincture based on the volume of an herb, the percentage alcohol that's extracted, and what you would expect to then have as the milligram. So this has been largely worked out. The variable is every batch of herbs is going to have a slightly different potency. So the phytochemical makeup of a batch of herbs that's grown in my backyard in Western Massachusetts may be vastly different than that same herb growing in Colorado at 6,000 feet, because the stress on the herb, the soil conditions will bring out different constituents. So that's the variable. But the reality is that's part that could be a variable in a capsule as well. But you can look at tinctures and kind of have a general sense of the milligrams. I think the milligrams are helpful because you're not just sort of saying, oh, take a handful of this or a pinch of that, but you also have something that's reproducible and repeatable batch to batch. You know, that's been a big issue with cannabis products, right? Like, we know that cannabis has efficacy for certain things, but if every strain has a different amount of THC or other cannabinoids or CBD, then it's hard to get a reproducible effect. So if somebody wants to get anxiety relief and not get high, they have to know that from batch to batch, they're going to get the same results. And the same if we're treating somebody who has a serious medical condition. You know, if somebody has lupus, you can't mess around with how much of a dose of an immunosuppressive they're getting. So, you know, I think that we have to look at the severity of the conditions that we're treating in relationship to how exact we feel like we need to be.
Thank you.
Aviva.
You're welcome. Yeah.
Just a quick, two quick questions. I'm a psychiatrist and I was wondering the rhodiola. Have you ever used it for PTSD where people have nightmares? Because you had said that I think that it calmed the dreams. And I was just wondering if you found it effective for that.
I haven't specifically tried it for that, but I definitely would specifically try it for that. The main contraindication for rhodiola is just not using it with people who have bipolar affective disorder. That's where it can be, particularly if they have mania, that's where it can be agitating. So that is an indication for it, but I haven't tried it for that.
Okay.
I would love to hear, when you do.
Well, secondly, my question kind of piggybacking on what the other women were saying was, you know, I'm very comfortable, you know, writing, you know, let's just say olanzapine, you know, 20 yeah. milligrams, you know, as, but I'm not sure, like, how do you prescribe the actual, like, tinctures or, like, are you telling your patients, okay, buy this from Mountain Herbs and this is how you make it? And I was wondering, like, from a MD, like, that's totally new to this, like, how do you do it?
So yeah, I used to actually have my own apothecary and dispense myself, but now with patients all over the country and the volume, it's not something I do anymore. But when I was formulating myself, it was really easy. I could just walk into my apothecary and put the tinctures together and then capsules or teas and send them home with it. It's a lot to do, so I don't recommend that. You almost, you know, at a full pace practice, you would need a separate person who's doing that. So what I typically do in my practice for if I'm treating a specific condition, I will identify the proprietary products that I feel like have the closest blends to what I'm looking for and then recommend those. Because, as much as I love tinctures made by my local herbalists and sold at the co-op, one, from a medical doctor's perspective, you're liable for any bad outcomes. And if they can't batch trace, if they don't have GMPs, it's not worth risking your license on that. And you could be. So what I do is in that case, I look, you know, kind of meet the person where they are. If it's a patient who is pretty experienced with herbs and natural things, and they do their own cooking at home and all that, I will then say, like I did today with someone, they have fibroids and needed a blend that had lady's mantle and yarrow, but there is no blend like that on the market. So this is a young, educated person in the wellness space. I was able to say to her, XYZ company has Yarrow, XYZ company has Ladies Mantle, get yourself a 2 ounce bottle, mix them half, you know, and mix them and just take it. But more often, so you can do that, right? You can say, you know, you can get your 5 tinctures at Mountain Rose, you can get your 5 tinctures at Herb Farm, and then mix them. The problem with that then is the smallest tincture amount you can get is 1 ounce. And typically a 1 ounce bottle is gonna be at least $12. So now somebody has to buy, if there's 5 herbs in that, they have to buy 5 tinctures. They're spending $60. They take the first dose and they say, that gave me a headache. And now they're out of luck and have spent a lot of money. So I find it easier to identify, and you can go into my formulary, which is, or just go to FullScript. They're a great company for physicians to use, all of us practitioners to use. For those of you who are not licensed or certified and can't use the FullScript formulary yourself, you can go through my website and use it that way. So you can use my access. I have a back-end formulary that's just for my patients. So there are products in my back-end formulary that I don't put in the general consumer one, which is what everyone would access, just for safety reasons. Like, I don't want just to have DHEA in a front end formulary or, you know, certain things. But then I'll go through and I'll have like a set of companies that I feel comfortable with. Pure Encapsulations, Integrative. Pure got bought out by one of the questionable, they got bought out by a pharmaceutical company. So there's, you know, quandaries around these things. A lot of these really nice earthy companies end up getting bought out by multinationals. So then, you know, you're still basically using pharma indirectly, but Integrative Therapeutics, Herb Farm, Gaia Herbs, Herb Farm 2, they'll make proprietary blends. And what happens is sometimes you end up getting, you know, you're going for a blend that has rhodiola and reishi and St. John's wort, let's say, and you find that, but then they've also added B complex or they've added something else. So you have to kind of compromise. Maybe that wasn't exactly what you were looking for, but you go with it if it's still reasonably appropriate for your patient.
Okay. And then so that you can you could just get like a very particular, like take 2 capsules of it.
Exactly. And okay. So in my actual formulary, because I use an electronic medical records. If you were to go into my electronic medical records and I'm typing a note for my patient and I'm putting in their supplements and their prescriptions, just the way if you were to pull up a pharmaceutical, it would allow you to type in your dose. I have presets that I use, just like you could have presets with your dose. I have presets that I use that'll say, take 2 capsules twice a day, or it might say take as directed on the package, but then I'll adjust it particularly, you know. I might say, look, like I've got a, you know, maybe there's a product that I want to use that has, it says, you know, on the package, it says take 4 capsules a day, but it's got vitamin B6 in it. And now if they take 4 capsules of that, they're getting 100 milligrams of vitamin B6. But they're also taking a multivitamin that has 50 milligrams of vitamin B6. And now they're getting, you know, edging toward a toxic dose of vitamin B6. Then I'll say, okay, only take 2 capsules of the herb. So you're kind of making these complex adjustments. But it's sort of a workaround when you're combining herbs and nutrients and also pharmaceuticals. If you're just purely using herbs, then you can formulate yourself. You know, you can work with a company that will custom formulate for you. There aren't too many that are doing that with tinctures and capsule products though. Lots of workarounds, unfortunately. If you are an herbalist or any other health provider who your license wouldn't be on the line if something happened with a batch, which for physicians, we definitely are on the line, medically and legally, then you can formulate yourself or you can work with a local herbalist who can create tinctures or teas for you as needed.
Okay, that's really helpful. I will say the idea of a proprietary blend that's already made that they could purchase like through FullScript or whatever, that seems much more, that like calms my nerves so much
FullScript
more.
FullScript and Emerson. Emerson Ecologics is the other big company and I've used them too. And those are the two. I've switched to FullScript over the years only because it was an easier integration with my electronic medical record. And you know, I think a lot of the companies now, a lot of the companies now are pretty savvy. So a lot of the companies that are catering to the integrative physicians and practitioners, the MDs, the functional practitioners, they're looking at what the study doses are. And they're typically, and I know this because I sometimes consult for various companies and they'll, you know, they'll send me the tear sheet, if you will, on that herb or on that supplement and say, you know, we're going to include this, this, and this at this dose of milligrams because that's what was studied. And so, you know, it's a win-win for everybody. Especially if you can go back, especially as a licensed health professional, if you can go back and say that there is a study with that dose that supports your use of it. It's helpful. Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hello, I have a question.
Who is this talking? Yes.
This is Wendy Higgins.
Hey.
Hi. I'm your neighbor to the north. I'm in North Berkshire County. Hi. I have a question.
Autumn is coming to Berkshire County. I'm so sad.
What's that?
I said autumn is coming to our county.
Oh, it is. It is. I have a question about the HPA activation.
Yes.
I had a traumatic birth with my daughter more than 11 years ago. I had preeclampsia and she was born a preemie. And when I read about the impact of the cortisol levels and, you know, I've just been wondering if I may still have, well, I definitely still have trauma. How do I kind of backtrack and work through the fact that when I was 29 years old, I didn't have any of the self-care? Any of the wonderful things that you've put in your workbook. So I'm still feeling overwhelmed. I'm often depleted. And of course, since she was born, I now have twins in addition to hers. So I guess my question is, does it make sense that that my HPA axis is still activated and kind of what the best way to move forward with that is?
Well, first, thank you for sharing. And you know, everyone, when you share something personal, you know, thank you for trusting this space to do that. And Wendy, you know, definitely thank you for being here and sharing that. Yes, so the studies that have been done and they're really more like pretty recent, but the data that's coming out is more what I should say, of people who are looking at the impact of birth trauma on women's long-term mental health has definitely shown that people are having pervasive and persistent or intrusive thoughts, even sometimes 20 years later. And they can really identify those thoughts, those memories, those body memories, and all the life things that can come with that. Depression, not insinuating that you have any of this, but for women in general with trauma and birth trauma, depression, anxiety, PTSD symptoms, attachment. Sometimes there are attachment issues with baby, like people, women have been shown to either become like hyper attached to those babies or maybe have attachment challenges with those babies, because even like for women immediately in the first year after trauma, sometimes nursing the baby is a reminder of the invasion of their body. Really like a lot of complex issues that surround birth trauma. And then also physical issues, physical memories of pain, depending on what the trauma was. It can really affect women's partner relationship if they're with that partner, sexual relationship, like lots of really complex issues. And what has been shown is that it from a neurocognitive level, there is scrambling, for lack of a better word, or shifting that happens, and activation, a chronic activation of the HPA axis. Can we say for sure that, you know, it was from that? If you know it was from that, that's the bottom line. If you know it was from that time, then it was from that time. And that's really sort of the way birth trauma is being looked at. I would say that adaptogens can definitely be part of support in terms of resetting the HPA axis. Breathing, meditation, yoga, getting massage, all of those sort of day-to-day things that one might be able to fit in, certainly harder right now for yoga. You can use something like Yoga Glow online, which is a great, they have great restorative and calming yoga. You know, Hatha, it doesn't always have to be like a hard flow. Doesn't have to be that at all. Spending time in nature, walking. But also, I think that other therapies are really important. So if there's a lot of physical memory, then, I'm not putting you on the spot or not meaning to, just in general, you being anyone experiencing this, one can do somatic therapy. That can be helpful. Movement, body positioning, physical therapy that kind of unlocks what's going on physically that gets stored in the body. And if it's more cognitive, emotional, fatigue, overwhelm, memories, then I think EMDR is actually, in my experience, the best therapeutic approach. There's actually a therapist here who's phenomenal. She's in Great Barrington. I'm sure she's practicing from home right now. Who, if you write to me offline, I'll give you her name and I'm happy to even connect you with her if that's something you want to pursue. I've had other students who have confided issues that I've connected her with. And I've had a couple of patients who had just horrific life traumas who have had amazing transformation using EMDR and particularly with her. If you want to, you know, for anyone who is working with trauma, whether your own or you know, wanting to go deeper, helping your clients or patients. We actually have a student in the course, Billy Harrigan, who's a Canadian. Billy, I don't know if you're on here tonight. Billy is a very skilled birth trauma worker. She and I did a workshop together for the I Deserve Birth Support free group that Laura and other students in the course have been wonderful about helping support the support group here, Laura Bartko and Lisa Palladino and others. But there's a talk with Billy Harrigan and me that you can access. I also did a workshop that wasn't posted on there that I can see if I still have the Zoom link to the recording, because that's about healing trauma that I did. It was like a whole hour and a half on healing postpartum trauma. Yeah. And then one other thing for those of you who want to go deeper into trauma work in general, the book, The Body Heals, The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk is excellent. The Transformation by Jim Gordon, which I had the honor of writing a blurb for the back of the book, is really, really good too. And then Dr. Gordon, Jim, he's a close personal friend, has an organization called the Center for Mind-Body Medicine. And they do, and their trainings are online right now. And the people I know who have done those trainings, I haven't done it yet. I've taught with Jim, but I haven't actually done the training yet. I'm one of their faculty for food as medicine. People say that level one and level two are really transformative. And a lot of people who take that training are people who are working to heal their own trauma, but they're practitioners who ultimately work with other people with trauma. So those are just some various thoughts, Wendy. But feel free to write me and I'll connect you up with Tammy. If it's, yeah, go ahead. Thank you for sharing, Wendy.
Yeah, thank you, Wendy, for sharing and for trusting us. Okay, am I heard?
Yes, you're heard.
All right. My name's Victoria. I'm in Miami, Florida. We're originally from Argentina. And we had watched one of your...
Hello, Victoria's little person.
This is Kitsan.
Hi.
You've been mentioning, I'm the only boy. Yeah, he is.
Is your name Yitzhak?
Quetzal. No,
oh,
it's
Quetzal.
Now what?
Nice.
So we had watched your adaptogens webinar. And I'm a doula. So you mentioned there that pregnant women shouldn't use adaptogens. I understand some of them can be a little bit too stimulating, like ginseng. And so I kind of get that intuitively. I'm wondering about those calming ones like Dulce and those really calming adaptogens. And was it more of like, just to play it safe, we're going to just not have women use any adaptogens? One moment, Papi. Or is there some like evidence or some experience that where that comes from?
Yeah, yeah. So great question. So with Shizandra, which is a TCM adaptogen used for the kidneys, but also a general adaptogen, with Shizandra, there is evidence not to use it because it's a uterine stimulant. So with Shizandra, it's actually used also in China to stimulate uterine contractions. So that one is absolutely contraindicated, like just bottom line. Oh, I see a tiny little baby. Oh my gosh. I just noticed like a little newborn.
I think it's this one. Yeah, he's 12 days old.
Oh my gosh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh, look at that little head. Oh, neck tone happening. So Shizandra is definitely out.
What?
In traditional Chinese medicine, adaptogens are sometimes used in formulas. So for example, there's a ginseng formula that's used to quote unquote stabilize the fetus, even in a threatened miscarriage. My rationale for not recommending adaptogens in pregnancy is two things. One, when I'm in doubt about something's use in pregnancy, and there are no studies on the safety of adaptogens in pregnancy, I tend to not use it. I tend to err on the side of caution. There's no significant traditional use of adaptogens as adaptogens in pregnancy, meaning when ginseng might be used as a small amount in a Chinese medicine formula that has 15 other herbs, but you would never in Chinese medicine, to my knowledge, use ginseng as a tonic for a pregnant woman, maybe postpartum in a soup or broth or stew. But in Ayurveda, in Chinese medicine, you wouldn't just use adaptogens the way we use them as a tonic in pregnancy. So there's no traditional basis for that. And so for me, if there's no scientific evidence for it and no traditional basis for it, that to me is like, take it off the table. But even more so, and what keeps me from using them in pregnancy is that when we get pregnant, our Th1, Th2 immune system dominance shifts, right? So normally, when we're not pregnant, our body recognizes foreign objects and fights against them, right? When we're pregnant, our body shifts immunity and our immune systems don't become weaker, but we have a shift in our defense so that we don't reject the baby as a foreign object. So that's one thing. We know that adaptogens shift the immune system. So I can't say that the adaptogens wouldn't shift the immune system in a way that is not intended in pregnancy. So that's one reason. The other reason is that when we're pregnant, our body releases more blood sugar. We actually, let me take that back, that's not true. When we are pregnant, we become slightly more insulin resistant, right? So you want to not be insulin resistant in general. Insulin resistance is one of the things that causes inflammation, can lead to diabetes, because you want your cells to welcome the insulin in. When we become more insulin resistant outside of pregnancy or become too insulin resistant in pregnancy, then we have too much blood sugar circulating and we can become gestational diabetic or diabetic. But when we're pregnant, we become naturally a little bit more insulin resistant because your body is saying, let me not take all that blood sugar into my cells. Let me keep a little bit more of it circulating to get to the baby for nourishment and growth. One of the things that many of the adaptogens do is reduce insulin resistance, right? So you use adaptogens like ginseng, for example, for prediabetes and diabetes. So again, if our bodies are meant to become insulin resistant a little bit, and now I'm going to give something that reduces that insulin resistance, I don't know how that impacts the baby. The third thing, and maybe even the most important of all the three things with the adaptogens, is that they shift our cortisol levels. And we know from traditional use of licorice in, I think it's in Sweden. I forget, I have to look at the country. But women who use licorice every day, just as licorice candy, but they use like real actual licorice, have lower birth weight babies. And that is because of the impact of the licorice on cortisol as an adaptogen. It may have some impact of the licorice on blood pressure, but it's not what it seems like is causing the issue. All of the adaptogens have an impact on cortisol. And that is not something I want to shift for the baby. So if somebody could do a great study and look at insulin resistance and cortisol levels and blood sugar, then I'd be like, and it's all fine. Then I'm like, great, no problem. With Tulsi is probably the one area I would make the exception and say, you know, if somebody wants to have Tulsi tea once in a while, like, because Tulsi is really the only adaptogen you would actually take as a tea, like for, you know, like a beverage, I could add Tulsi to my tea and it would be delicious. Wouldn't do that with most of the adaptogens. So I would say Tulsi tea once in a while as a beverage, I'm sure is fine. Like green tea is fine once in a while, or coffee is fine once in a while in pregnancy. But those are my reasons. And until I can get those answered, I don't see any reason taking a risk in pregnancy. That's the main thing. I hope that all makes sense. It's a long answer, but I hope that all makes sense.
That was perfect. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Postpartum, no problem. You know, postpartum, you can see what's happening with the baby, and not very much would get through the breast milk. So with postpartum, I have no issues with it at all.
So I just have one little add-on to that. I know there's this green product that I've been really enjoying lately, and it has maca. It has maca root in it. And the company itself has actually, deemed it safe for pregnancy. But I obviously, after watching your webinar, I've just been very cautious to ever suggest any kind of adaptogens to pregnant women. I know in Peru, maca is kind of like, they use it a lot. But it is very stimulating too. I don't know. Is there anything that I could share with them? Because I actually have reached out to the product. And I'm like, you know, I think you guys should reconsider stating that it's safe for pregnant women, and this is who I've learned it from, and these are her credentials, you know, please look into but is there
so maca is, so you know, again, also it's like a scale of things, right? Like the way I'm saying rhodiola as a tea, I'm sorry, not rhodiola, holy basil, Tulsi as a tea once in a while, that's using it as a food, right?
Yeah.
Maca in Peru is used as it's a tuber, so it's used kind of like somebody might use a turnip or a potato.
Yeah.
But it's probably not going to be eaten. It's cattle, it's fed to their animals all the time, including for fertility, for nourishment. It's very nutritious. So I think if somebody's eating maca the way we might eat, you know, a potato, and they're eating that as part of their diet once in a while,
right?
That's also different than taking, you know, 5 grams of maca and putting it in the smoothie. So I think it's how we're using it and the concentration of the dosing. I wouldn't recommend somebody to eat it every day unless we knew that it was safe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had a question
for your webinar to those people, like.
Yeah. Have them reach out. I'm surprised. Most companies are very strict about what they say is safe in pregnancy for liability. I get emails all the time, like, you know, just from people out there in the world who are saying, this product says it's not safe for pregnant and breastfeeding women. And it'll be like chamomile or milky oats or something. I'm like, no, they all have to just say that.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I just had a follow-up question about the maca, not in pregnancy, just for every day. If someone is treating it like a food, would you still run into the kind of 12 weeks, or is it something that shouldn't be taken daily, or if it's just being like added to like a smoothie or a yogurt bowl, like over?
No, I think it's fine. I mean, if again, that's more like if they're eating it like part of their food and they're not pregnant. That would be probably more traditional, like how it's used traditionally. It wouldn't be used as a smoothie, obviously.
Right, right.
But yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, maca is a funny herb too. The scientific data behind maca is not that strong, interestingly. It's sort of like, meh, it's okay. But as a nutritive food and as a traditional use, it's very strong. I find that it's one of the few herbs that women will tell me, wow, I tried that and it really upset my stomach. Or like, actually, my stomach hurt. Like I got, like not their belly, but their stomach actually hurt. So I usually have people try it just a small amount. If it doesn't work for them in a smoothie, try a capsule. If it doesn't work for them in a capsule, try a tincture. And then also, I'm not sure what the maca market is like right now, but if they're getting older product, like from a few years ago, it may also be adulterated. So, you know, you want it to be fresh, new maca. Mm-hmm. Not new, like fresh, like, but recent product, recent dried product, like, you know, Gaia or a maca powder, for example.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Who is
it? Okay, great. I'm an MD, family medicine and lifestyle medicine, and it's a case that I have. It's a 37-year-old female that has a history of sexual trauma and a history of leaky gut, and she also has Hashimoto's, and recently she's had more and more kind of inflammatory adhesive capsulitis, like frozen shoulder, and certainly has a significant amount of gut symptoms, undigested food in her stool, and bloating. She's gluten sensitive as well as dairy sensitive. And she's had some benefit with L-glutamine, but she's also having kind of skin issues as well, kind of reflective of that. Well, she'll get hives sometimes and then other skin breakouts. And I think she, you know, she needs some, this is kind of going back to our last lesson, but stepping up the L-glutamine, but just wondering in that scenario, and she's working on a lot of lifestyle stuff, increasing gradually fiber, more tolerance, better, more plants in her diet, and that's going well, but she can't really tolerate raw stuff too much. She can do some, and she can do some sauerkraut, so she's really actually doing pretty well in terms of building on her fiber. But I'm just wondering about what products that to step up from there. Where would you go?
Okay, so wait, what's your name? I can see it. I can see your name.
I'm sorry, it's Susanna. Susanna.
Oh, Susanna. Okay, sorry, Susanna. We have a lot of MDs here tonight, guys. Interesting. Yeah. Love it. I love that. You know, I'm so excited to see MDs in the course, and just one, it means that women are more just like open, like it's just seeing MDs who are more open to herbs, but also knowing that so many women out there are going to get the benefit of seeing MDs who are using herbs. It's so beautiful. Okay, so she's got history of sexual, she's 36, 37, history of sexual trauma, Hashimoto's. Mm-hmm. Is her Hashi's well stabilized?
She's well controlled on 90 of nature thyroid, and her she's got both TPO antibodies that are up in like the 80s ish, which is higher than they've been before, and also
anti-thyroglobulin.
Yeah, thyroglobulin around the same level.
Okay,
but she's controlled, I can't remember TSH, but it's less than two. It's like 1.7.
Okay, and she's having hives. And so are you thinking that, and she's gluten intolerant.
Actually, another side thing is that she had this recent frozen shoulder. Her ortho injected steroids. 2 days later, she broke out in hives all over. So she's kind of having skin breakouts intermittently.
And so you think it's a gut issue primarily? Is that what you're feeling?
I think she's got a lot of gut issues. She has historically as well, which is why she's actually been on the L-glutamine before. And she was also on some digestive enzymes. But but yeah, you know, just loose undigested food in her stool is why she's really sensitive to a number of foods. I mean, dairy and gluten being two, but also just when she overdoes too much raw, too many beans, those kind of things. And so, you know, some of the FODMAP kind of stuff just will send her over to the edge in high quantities so she can tolerate a little bit.
Yeah. So one, I mean, you know, it's easy to sort of jump right to her history of sexual trauma and then that connection to IBS, which is such a strong historical connection, right, in the literature. So making sure that she's getting the support and healing that maybe that if there's a connection between her history of sexual trauma and the IBS symptoms, it's something like 50% of women who have had sexual trauma have developed gut symptoms, and it's usually IBS. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I always want to make sure I'm looking at that piece appropriately. It sounds like her thyroid's well controlled. So have you done like a full elimination diet with her?
No, not yet. Really, she's just been, she's getting the processed foods out where she's somewhat, and she actually did try to go plant-based for a while, but it was just too, it was more than her, she needs to be more gradual.
Yeah, too much raw, yeah. Well, it sounds like she might need a more, you know, what I'm going to loosely call a warming diet. Those of you who study Ayurveda or TCM know what I mean, but a warming diet would be less raw, more steamed vegetables, you know, simple cooked proteins, soups, and simple meals, you know, like a piece of salmon, a baked sweet potato and some greens, but cooked greens, steamed, sauteed, baked, so that the food is easily digestible for her. Mm-hmm. I would definitely work with the, and also just make sure she's like eating mindfully. Is she stopping? Is she chewing? You know, is she rushing through her meal because she's having undigested food? I would definitely work to, get some nervines going for her, and nervines that have a nice digestive component to it. So something like blue vervain or lemon balm, those are calming, but they also help the gut. And I would start there, but with an elimination diet. So I would probably go really simple with those calming nervine herbs that support gut ease. Okay. Lavender, chamomile, lemon balm, blue vervain. Those are the ones that come to mind. Okay, and ginger is a great one. Not so much a nervine, but great for the gut and nice with those other herbs. Great. And then I focus on the elimination diet. See if you can identify what the triggers are. Does she need kind of a FODMAP light? Not a full FODMAP. It's so complicated. And
yeah.
But, you know, kind of like keeping some of those foods out for a while, 3 months, see if there are other food triggers. You know, with the hives, it's interesting because hives can be just a reaction to something that she had. If she's having recurrent skin outbreaks, are they stress triggered? Does she have histamine intolerance? You know, is that a piece of what's going on for her? I would explore this, but I would always just start with simple herbs and a simple elimination diet and relaxation, meditation, if anything that she's willing to do to kind of de-escalate any HPA axis. And if she hasn't done trauma work, then that may be a piece of it too. The L-glutamine, the infusion from lesson two, those are the zinc carnosine. Those I think of more when somebody overtly has leaky gut. And she may, I mean, that may be a piece with the Hashimoto's. It may be that there's, you know, a leaky gut component. And then I would definitely do gluten-free if she knows she's gluten intolerant. Yeah.
For sure. Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Ladies, I'm having a feeling it's like all kinds of time here. I have no idea what time it is. What time is it on the East Coast here? 9:09. All right. So just out of respect to everyone who doesn't want to leave because they're afraid to miss something, we'll end tonight. I love this time with you guys. And if you wrote in a question and I didn't get to it because we've had so many live questions, call-in questions. I don't know what to say, like face-to-face questions. Everyone's live and calling in. Post your question tomorrow or tonight on the top Facebook post that's there, and I'll get to that before I post a new one. So when we have an event on Wednesday, I don't usually post a new post on Wednesday. And then tomorrow around 4 o'clock, the food as medicine lesson's going to go up, and there's going to be a lot in there. So you heard me talking about FODMAP, elimination diet. I'm going to give you all the tools to learn to use those. And so there's an audio recording. It's 3 separate short recordings of the PDF. Have a listen to the PDF if you want to, but well, I would have a listen to the PDF, but the real meat of it, so to speak, is in the actual food as medicine 3 videos. That's where I really go through everything. The PDF was older, but as a courtesy, I recorded it, but the 3 videos are newer. And there's a lot of sort of adjunct materials that are there for your reference if you want to use them. And then you're going to get 3 food journals. You can pick which one you want to review. Once you've gone through all the videos, the homework for that is to review one of the food journals that I've given you, and also to do your own food journal. When we get together for the next live session, we're going to spend about 45 minutes reviewing and unpacking those food journals. So what we're going to do is interactively, we're going to talk about each of the ones, and the one that you focused on, you can have them all printed in front of you when we get together. And then the one that you focused on, especially, you know, make sure to like be interactive about it. I won't put anyone on the spot, but it'll give us a chance to really go deep with how to use a food journal effectively, meaningfully, respectfully, and what do different aspects of what we're looking for mean. And I think you'll have a lot of fun with it. And then doing your own food journal is really mostly about, you know, everything we're asking other people to do, we want to make sure that we do it, because it's hard to help someone else with certain things if we haven't done the experience. So if you've never done a food journal before, spend 3 days. You don't have to turn it in. You're not going to be asked to show it to anyone. It's just, what is the experience like of remembering to do it? And what's the emotional experience of it? Are you tempted to change things? Or, you know, does it give you an increased awareness? For anyone who has a history or an active eating disorder, if doing the food journal for yourself is too much of a trigger for you, then don't do it. That's totally okay. It's not going to be required because of that. But everyone is being asked to do the interpretive one, where you pick one and interpret it. So there'll be a pregnant one, pregnant mama one, a vegan one, and then there's one other that's more like kind of a standard American diet. Any questions that didn't get answered, post them under the Facebook post that's up there, and I'll get to them over the next few days into the weekend, and then we'll have a new post next week. And have fun. Have fun. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Night, everybody.
Thank you.
Great as always. Thank you.
Sorry about the first part of the recording.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.